the Giants and brought me in a lot of ball games.
Which was there a catcher you preferred working with?
Well, believe it or not, we had Danning, and then Walker Cooper came over from the Cardinals, and we had Ken O'Day, and we had Bots Lombardi. And when I first came up, we had Gus Mancuso, Ray Berries, who was a pitching coach for the White Sox for a number of years.
Gabby Hartner was there for a while.
Gabby Hartner. So all of those, the one I really, believe it or not, like to pitch to is Ray Berries, because he was able to read me pretty well, and we hit it off together. Of course, Gabby used to catch me too, Gabby Hartner. But there again, it's strange when I can remember when I was a 15, 16-year-old kid, you know, and all of these fellows were idols of mine. And then all of a sudden, instead of being idols, you're talking with them, you're living with them, you're playing cards with them, and it's really strange how things work out.
It certainly is. Was there a particularly big name hitter that you had his number? Can you recall anybody
I really can't recall. And incidentally, Frank Gustine, who was with Pittsburgh, he was on the same, he and I played on the same high school team here in Chicago.
Wow.
And he went to Pittsburgh, and then of course I went to the New York Giants, which is don't happen very often.
No, either. No, not out of any high school whatsoever. What was it like in those days with the management and the press and so forth? What sort of course you were in one of the great media markets of the world. What was it, did you feel the papers treated you and the team fairly most of the time? What kind of coverage was there?
Well, I think the press was, as far as I was concerned, the press really didn't bother you too much. I think Bill Terry was real strict with the press. He wouldn't leave them in the clubhouse, you know what I mean, where they could have the do anything they wanted. Maybe once in a while they let them in, but most of the time the press talked to you pre-game in the dugouts, around the dugouts. So. And of course, when you went on the road, they were usually, we traveled by train then, and they were on the same train, and they were able to corral you then and talk to you. But overall, I think they were very fair. Let's put it that way.
I wanted to ask you also what it was like being on the road 50 years ago. A lot different than flying in a chartered jet.
Sure. Of course, out of New York, some of the shorter hauls we'd bus it, but most of the time it was trains.
Like Boston or Philadelphia?
Yeah. Of course, everywhere else coming in, we'd usually leave out of New York, and we'd come to Chicago and then go to St. Louis and go to Cincinnati. From New York to Chicago, that pretty much a 20-hour trip, if I remember right. So it was riding the rails for 20 hours and playing cards or pinochle or whatever. You get your wildly hours away. You couldn't do very much. And it was tough, yeah. Especially if you got off the train and you had to go play a ball game because your legs were. A lot of times your legs would swell up from doing all that sitting, and took you a couple of days to even get shake the ride, you know. But now, what the heck, they hop a plane and they're there in a couple hours, so quite a bit different. Of course, everything was, we didn't have anything west of the Mississippi. I mean, there was no clubs out west. All our traveling was from St. Louis East. That was it.
A but you certainly were at the far end of it. It was a very long train ride to St. Louis.
Yeah, and then we, and of course, when we come to Chicago, it was 100 in Chicago, and we'd go to St. Louis, it'd be 105 in St. Louis, and then we'd go to Cincinnati, which was the ballpark was down in a like in a valley, and it would be 110 there, it seemed like. By the time we got through those three towns, we were really running through the ringer. And of course, in those days, no air conditioning, no nothing. You know, you had to try to keep as cool as you could. I can remember in our hotel rooms, we'd soak a sheet in a bucket of ice water, you know, and then hang it up somehow and put the fans on the other side of it to blow some cool air into the room. It was altogether different than they have it now.
Yeah, sure was. All those different ballparks, is there one that you particularly like to pitch in?
Well, I pitched in about all of them. The only ones I didn't, let's see. I like to pitch in both St. Louis and Cincinnati. I seem to have good luck pitching in both of those towns. In Boston, the same way, Philly. I liked them all. There was even the Cubs Park. I thought the Cubs Park was a great park. Of course, it was every time we came to Chicago, that's my hometown, so I was able to get back to see Mountain Park, you know.
Was there a ballpark that you felt really didn't suit your style of pitching, or that you thought was a sort of a bad luck park?
Oh, I think Ebbets Field. I didn't particularly like Ebbets Field at the right field. You know, you had that high scoreboard. Yeah, uh-huh. That it made baseball a little odd playing there because fly balls to right would be wrecking off the right field wall and so forth. I didn't think that was.
What about the rivalry between the Giants and the Dodgers?
Was,
did you like the fans in
Ebbets
Field?
That was. Well, we went to play Brooklyn. I mean, none of the smaller pitchers ever got in the games. Oh. It was always Hubble and Schumacher and Melton because they went with experience and everything because the rivalry was real intense, real intense.
Important to win those games, wasn't it?
Well, the rivalry was such. I mean, the people from New York fans hated Brooklyn, and Brooklyn hated New York. So it was just one of those rivalries that was down through the years.
Exactly. How good a fielder were you as a pitcher?
No, good.
What was the toughest play?
I'd say. Toughest play would probably be covering first on anything hit to the first base side, or maybe swinging bunts on the third base line. Those are the tough plays for a pitcher.
Who was the first baseman most of
that
time?
Well, first year was Babe Young, and the second year was Johnny Mines in 42.
Do you recall a particularly outstanding defensive play that you saw while you were there?
Not really. I've seen every kind of a defensive play there is in baseball. And when you watch ball games for 10, 12 years, you know, there's all kinds of good plays.
Who had the best outfield arm that you saw while you were there? Anybody stand out?
Well, I mean, the one that was able to really cover his position and know everything about his position probably was Mel Ott, because Polo Grounds was a tricky right field. Real short mm-hmm. down the line, and then it angled out sharply towards center, and he knew how to play. They had to know how to play the wall, and come up throwing, and I think Adi did as good a job as anybody. But you had good left fielder and Joe Moore. He could throw well. Center field, with several center fielders. Hank Lieber, he had a good arm. So all in all, in those days, believe it or not, most of your outfielders had good arms, it seemed like. And nowadays, in going back into the 30s, you had so many minor league teams that were in Class D, Class C, Class B. Every major league club, although there was only 16 major league clubs, they all had, the Cardinals must have had 50 teams. They must have had 50 or more, the Cardinals. The Giants, they sort of got into it in the tail end. They didn't have too many. But you had so many players, and good players or potential players to choose from, that the big league players had to be on their toes all the time, because if they're going to hit 225, like a lot of these ball players are hitting today, 225, they're not going to be around. They didn't stay around.
What are the biggest changes that you see in the game today and the game that game when you played? You touched on a couple of them, but...
Well, I think they've taken too much away from the pitchers, for one thing. They've lowered the mound. They let guys get up there and take toe holds. You can't pitch them inside. You can't do anything to shake them loose from that home plate. After all, home plate is, it belongs to the pitcher, you know what I mean? And some guy's leaning over it and they're swinging from their heels on a pitch. When I played ball, if somebody did that, the next pitch you could be sitting on the ground, you know what I mean? They got you out of that batter's box. After all, it belongs to the pitcher. Now the pitcher can't do anything, and these guys are going up there and they're swinging from right from their heels, and you can't do anything to shake them loose.
I suspect that you watch some ball games on TV, and I don't know if you get into games in the city or not.
All the time.
What about the strike zone?
Well, I think it's I think a lot of pitches that belt high, a little higher than belt high, they're all balls.
What was the top of the strike zone?
I think in my time it was they gave you a little more of the strike zone, belt high. It was a strike, but now it seems like you're limited to about 8 or 10 inches, and they don't give you anything up behind your belt. I think it's there's another thing I think is taken away from the pitcher. Mainly is that these hitters think they can get up there and, you know, they can keep unwinding and winding, and then when they hit one over the fence, they stand there and look at it going over the wall. They don't even run, you know what I mean?
What would have happened to the next batter if somebody had done that?
You know what would have happened to him. He'd have been, his cap would have been up there, but he wouldn't have been there.
He's down in the spot position.
I mean, that's showing up. We call it showing somebody up, and it wasn't, nobody did it.
I'm surprised sometimes when I see that pitcher who's been thrown a new ball by the umpire doesn't drill the runner as he's heading towards first base. What would they do to him if they did?
They'd fine him, throw him out of the game, and soak him about $5,000 is what they do to him. But now you can't even... You throw at him, and the umpire says the next time you're out of the ball game, or maybe even throws you out right then and there. You can't do a damn thing about it. So I think there's more ways than getting a guy out of the box by. You don't have to throw at his head. I mean, he's got feet too. You know, you can get him out of there in a number of ways. You can. His arms, just throw inside, but you don't have to throw at his head. But you got to be able to move somebody out of that box where they just don't dig in and have all the advantages they do have.
Well, that brings up another topic, and that is umpires. You know, Al Bartlett came up in 1940,
yeah,
about the same year that you
did. I was a good friend of Al's. He was a nice guy. And another umpire, I was trying to think of his name. He was with us at Camp Grant. They said that he was in the Army, too. I can't recall his name. He was a nice fellow, too. The umpires was the only one. There were several umpires. One I couldn't get along with, and a lot of other players couldn't get along with. I don't know if you remember the name Major Kurt.
Yes, George Major.
Yeah. No, he was a. He just. To me, I was always in trouble with him. You know.
Did he give you the thumb once?
Oh
again?
Yeah. Sure. He just the ball would be right down the middle of the plate. You know, and he. Ball, and you know, you take it a couple of times, and then you lose your cool, you know. You go, and then he makes some smart remark to you, so you got to retort, you know. You just can't let him push you around. So I was thrown out several times, but I wasn't the only one. Of course, a lot of those times you had umpire crews on your train, you know, as you were traveling. They didn't go by themselves like they go now. They're on different flights and everything else. But at that time, a lot of the umpiring crews rode your trains.
Did they eat with you then, too, and play cards, or was there some separation?
Well, there was some separation, but you always got, there was always a time when you got, some of them got together. But most of the time, they were separated. But you'd run into them in the, and the diners, because everybody went to the, ate in the diners, the passengers, the ball players. I mean, nobody was separated when you went to eat in the diners.
I'm sure. We talked a little bit about the style of managers, Bill Perry and Mel Ott. Do you think that Mel Ott might have had a better record as a manager had it not been for the war? Do you think he would have played as long as he did if it hadn't been for the war?
I doubt it. I think he probably would not have played during the war. I mean, you had most of your better players were drafted.
Were you drafted early? Or
well,
or
in 40, yeah.
We picked 42 seasons.
42
so.
Seasons, but I got my draft notice and sort of like the. First third of the season, I had my draft notice, and I didn't know whether I was going next week or the next month or whatever. I was out of Chicago, and I was in New York, and then they let me finish the season, and I wasn't drafted until the 42.
Well, sounds pretty unsettling, wasn't it?
Oh, it was.
Well, what was it like in the clubhouse for those people who knew they were going or didn't know if they were going? Or?
You can imagine, put yourself in the same position. You didn't know what the hell you were doing, or what was, if you're going to be around next week or next month or what. And I can remember the in 42, the next to the last game of the season. I think it was Boston that we were playing, and the fans got in the ball game by bringing 10 pounds of steel for the war effort. Of course, God, we must have 40,000-50,000 people that were in the ball game, and I think I had them beat 4-1 going into the ninth inning. And then the fans started coming out of the stands, and they went on the field, and they couldn't clear the field, so the umpires forfeited the game. All I had to get was three more batters out. I had my 12th ball game won, you know. Instead of I lost 9-0.
Oh, gee. Well, there were no night games here in 1942,
oh,
were there?
Yeah, I think there were. Yeah.
Oh. I mean, on the East Coast.
There. I don't remember.
I'd read someplace that they that they didn't want the lights
maybe
showing.
Maybe it could well be. But I remember like in 40. See, very few night games. You never played more than less than a dozen. The whole year. Everything was day, most of it was day ball. I would agree that probably there weren't any night games in 42 because we had blackouts and everything. And a lot of nights there when they were testing their air raid capacity and so forth, so probably that was true.
It must have been, let's see, there were two instances, I think, when the Giants had ball games interrupted or delayed by radio broadcasts. One was a speech by Roosevelt, and another, I think, was in Pittsburgh for a prize fight, of all things. Do you remember those at all? Okay. I've read about those, but I've never met anybody who might have been there during that time. Who would be could you pick an all-star team of those years that you played? Who was the best first baseman you saw? You mentioned Mize, for example.
Of course, you had a real good one in Chicago, Phil Cavaretta. Mm-hmm. He was as good as they came. And you had, of course, you had Dolph Camilli with Brooklyn. And Johnny Mize. I think you had Frank McCormick, I think was his name, but Cincinnati.
Right.
I don't recall who we had in Pittsburgh. But I would say overall, I would say that Johnny Mize for power, and Phil Cavaretta was a good glove man. He was a good hitter too, but he wasn't the power type hitter. In fact, Phil Cavaretta was playing in Chicago schools when I was playing too. Where he came from, Chicago High School.
What's the second base?
Billy Herman was pretty much winding up his career then, but he was a real good second baseman too. Shortstop, yeah. Billy Jurgis
behind you.
Yeah, Billy Jurgis, Pee Wee Reese. Those are two of the better ones.
And third, let's see, was Dick Bartell on the team?
Dick Bartell was with me, and then Billy Werber.
That's right.
Billy Werber. And both of those were good first base. Dick Bartell was a peppery type of guy that you would like to have on your team at any time.
I've heard that.
He was always in the game, hollering and keeping you on your toes. He was a real good ball player.
He just put a book out. I don't know.
I heard about it, but I haven't.
Rowdy Richard, I think, is the name of it.
Yeah, I saw a picture of him on TV. Somebody was interviewing him on TV when he did put the book out, and wouldn't be able to recognize him. You know what I mean? He was so old and shriveled. Of course, I would probably say the same thing about myself if somebody saw me. They probably wouldn't recognize me either. Remembering him the last time you seen him 50-some years ago, and then seeing him when he's 80, I think he was 85 or 86 now. What a great change took place. But he's still alive, right?
Yes, he certainly is. You mentioned Harry Danning a little bit earlier. You probably know he lives fairly close to
here. I heard that Harry lives over here in Valparaiso,
exactly.
Indiana.
Exactly.
I heard the Cubs announcer interview him one time before a Cubs ball game, but I was rather surprised because Harry originally came from California to see him settled in here at Valparaiso. That's a surprise.
You'd expect it to be the other way, born in Indiana and retiring in California.
Yeah, but Harry was—he was from the old school, you know, when they had the real good Giant teams in the 35, 36, or was it 35? I think they went up there, whenever it was. But he was a good catcher.
Right. Harry the the horse.
Yeah.
Well, I've been asked to ask you this question. If you owned a ball team, you mentioned Dick Bartel being the kind of player you'd want to have. If you owned a ball team, who are some of the players that you would want to have on it that you played with? And maybe there's somebody from today that you would put in that same category also.
Well, I'd sure like to have a third baseman like Stan Hack, who was with the Cubs. Shortstop Billy Jurgis or Dick Bartel. Second base would be a player like the Cubs have now, Sandberg. I would think that he would fit on any ball club. Same way with Dawson in the outfield. He would fit in with anybody. You have players today that I think are superb. They would have been, they're good ball players in any period of baseball. There are some that I think they're playing today that would have a hard time playing 40 years ago because of their batting average. I mean, you couldn't hit in the high 280s or 300, you weren't around, and you wouldn't have been playing.
Do you think they just don't know the strike zone? You think they're trying all to be long ball hitters?
That's what I say. They're hurting themselves by going up there and swinging from their heels every time they get in there. I mean, you had good ball players, Nellie Fox, Mel Ott, line drive hitters that were hitting 300 all of the time. They weren't swinging from their heels. But nowadays, ball clubs don't want an outfielder unless he can hit 25 home runs. But they don't care whether he can hit 25 home runs and hit 210, and they still pay him millions of dollars. But somebody that hits 300, we don't want him. He's a good hitter, but all he's doing is hitting singles. We want the runs. So they're willing to pay millions to somebody that can hit 25 home runs. And I think if you have a ball club that has 300 hitters that hit line drives, I think they're going to win a hell of a lot more ball games than these guys that are going to strike out 100 times and hit 25 home runs.
Well, the Giants were able to hit some home runs in like 46 and 47. There were some really good home run hitters at that time. But they didn't win the pennant either of those years.
Well,
unfortunately.
Well, it takes,
pitching.
I still think that pitching is the name of the game. If you got four or five, four good pitchers that can pitch in rotation and keep healthy, that wins more ball games than your 25 home run hitters win for you.
Were there any relief specialists?
We had a big guy in New York named Older Brown. He was a tremendous
Jumbo Brown.
Jumbo Brown. He was, God, he must have weighed 300 pounds. Big, heavy set guy, but he was a good reliever. And then we had another one after him, Ace Adams. He was a good reliever, but was altogether different then. I mean, if you were a starter and you got knocked out within the first three innings of a ball game, the next day you were in the bullpen. I mean, you didn't have specialists, so-called specialists, like you have now. Next day you were the guy that's going to get in the ball game if
the mop-up man.
Yeah. Now, you get knocked out, you just wait your turn the next 4 or 5 days. But there, you had a job to do, and next day you could bet you were in the bullpen.
there was a pitching coach for the Giants.
Dolph Lupke.
Oh. How valuable were coaches in those days? I've heard different reports from people.
I would say they're much more specialized now than they were then. Although Mr. Lupke, he was a relief pitcher in his day. He pitched for, I think, Cincinnati more than anybody. He was with the Giants some of the time, but he would sit down and talk to you. You know what I mean? Talk to you how to pitch the hitters and so forth, which at that time I don't think he had a lot of coaches that maybe they'd sign an old catcher, you know what I mean?
Right.